I'll get this tape going. This is an interview with David B. Putnam, and we're at 271 Broad Street South, Naples, Florida. And I'm going to ask David a question. What is the B for?
Benny. B-I-N-N-E-Y. Benny is a family name on my mother's side.
And do you know the zip code here in
Naples? The zip code in Naples is 33940.
33940. I'm going to set this microphone down. You'll be surprised. Inside of 5 minutes, we'll forget it's even here. In the meantime, I'm just going to check and make sure this thing's working, because it's been in my suitcase for about 2 weeks and it might have got banged around. It's my old faithful one. One other thing I want to add, that it's December 28, 1977, and it's just after high noon here in Naples, Florida, and we're in the living room of the apartment here at apartment 201, and in the living room is David and myself sitting on the couch. Patricia is here, and my wife Marie is here. There, we got all the business done. David, we've been talking a little bit, but we'll record it from here on out, and I want to start with you at the beginning. You were born in an early age. Do you remember when and where you were born?
It was quite an early age. I don't remember much of it, as a matter of fact. But I'm told that I was born May 20th in Bend, Oregon, 1913, about 106 years ago.
So May 20th, 1913?
Mm-hmm.
And in Bend, Oregon. You know, I have a photograph I'd be very happy to send you. The house is still standing. It's a house that your mother and dad built there in Bend. It's quite a famous house in Bend. And you lived there for about how long?
I only lived there as a child, really. I have very few recollections of Bend. We moved east shortly after that, and since then I've been on the go and out of a suitcase or a bureau drawer ever since.
Well, now, your father went to Bend about 1910, I believe, or 11?
He went to Oregon practically on their honeymoon. He was a secretary for the governor, and he had and operated a newspaper in Bend. His main mission was the newspaper business.
Now, you really skipped over a lot of your father's life there in one short sentence that really
at that age, I really don't recollect very much of it. Most of what I know about it is stuff that I've read about him and been told about him since then. But he had a wonderful time. He was a great outdoorsman. He was a great fly fisherman. He apparently was a very fine young newspaper man. And he apparently got a great deal of respect for his abilities and capabilities in that field. He was also interested in all sorts of other writing. But that pretty well covers it.
Not really. Your father was quite a remarkable young man, really. He came to Bend when he was just barely of age. I believe he was only about 21 years old.
Yes, he was in his early 20s.
And as far as your father's educational background is concerned, did you remember where he went to high school at?
No, I don't know about the high school part of it, but I think he went to Harvard and he went to University of California, I think. Mostly Harvard.
He went to the University of California at Berkeley. That's how he came out west in the first place. Father was more of a, rather than a scholastic type scholar, he was more of a scholar that would go out and study things on his own.
Well, he was very interested in everything and people and unusual happenings and doings. He was interested in history and development. He was really a very diversified man in all of his thinkings and doings. I think he was interested in the publishing field because it had such a wide open door to all the world. He came back and was active in the publishing business shortly after the Bend episode, and he spent most of his life that I recollect in the publishing business in New York. Billy sold out the company, and then he went with Paramount Pictures in California. But he was in charge of the New York office for quite a while.
Well, did your father, I mean, this is kind of interesting. Either you're being very modest for your father, or else his father is very modest for himself. Do you know that when he came to Bend, he only had $600 to his name that I know of, and he hadn't been there a year that he and another fellow had bought out the local Bend newspaper with your father as a senior editor and publisher. And correct me if I'm wrong or if you have no knowledge of these things, and that he started a campaign, a national campaign, because your father had the, at that early age, if you can imagine, a man 21 and 22 years old, had the knowledge to write articles and submit them to Eastern newspapers and whatnot to put pressure on the railroads to build a spur line into Bend, Oregon, because Bend, Oregon had timber, but there was no decent road, no way to export the timber. And they needed a railroad in order to get the farm products and timber out of the area. And it was mainly through your father's personal efforts that he was able to force the railroads at a national level to put the spur line into Bend, where previous politicians and whatnot for the previous decade or two before had been unable to get the railroads to put the money into putting that line in.
Well, I guess that's the power of the press over the politicians, isn't it?
It was in this case, and it was your father's personal abilities to write to the Eastern papers in a way, in a vein, that would put political pressure on the railroads to acquiesce to the few thousand people who lived in the Bend area to open up that railroad line.
Well, I think all you're proving is, Algin, that this interview is rather a waste of your time, because you know a lot more about it than I can remember.
I do think
that I have, now that you mention it, I have heard those things, and they come back out of a deep memory cache. I do know that he did a lot of corresponding. I now recall, thanks to you, that he was involved in the railroad bit. But he was involved in many, many things along
yes,
the same line.
Yes, he was. As a matter of fact, I'm putting this on the record on purpose. As a matter of fact, not only did he do that, but he took on the local water company who had been gouging the local citizenry. He took on every shady real estate and government operational deal that was being done at the local level. He was a tiger, an absolute tiger as a publisher at this very tender age of 21 or 22 that we're talking about, when he was working as a reporter and as a publisher for the Bend newspaper. And he received such wide acclaim that when they finally talked him into running for mayor of Bend, and imagine this, at age 23 he was elected as mayor of Bend, Oregon, you know, which is not a major metropolitan area, but it was the center of government and the major place of business in that part of Central Oregon at the time. He was known as the boy mayor of Bend. Now, the reason I think this is important, not that that isn't a matter of record, because it is, because James Crowell wrote about this in his thesis and whatnot, but the important thing is that your father didn't wear these on his sleeve, and either didn't emphasize them to you enough, which shows a certain humility on his part of a sort, or that you are showing that same humility by not relating these things to me.
No, frankly, I would love to start enumerating all of the things that I know he did as a wonderful guy. He was always involved in that type of thing, and he has told me many stories about how unpopular he was with certain factions out there as a youngster coming in from the East and trying to straighten out the Westerners. But most of them were always told in an amusing vein and not too serious.
Also, your mother was quite a woman at the time. Wasn't she the first or second woman to ever vote?
That I don't know. She's still quite a woman.
Yes, we met her.
She's quite a gal. I think they played tennis together out there and did things that women didn't do and that sort of thing for a while.
All right. Now, your father and mother used to entertain on Saturday evenings, and they were the entertainment social center and of Bend at the time. And no matter how late the party ran, and though I do not believe, in fact, I know that your father did not partake of alcoholic spirits to any excess in his earlier years. We'll get to the later years later. He was not a teetotaler in the sense that he wouldn't take a glass of wine or take a drink, but he was known far and wide never to drink to excess, and the parties that they threw were not that type of, they were dances and whatnot. But no matter how late the party ran, the living room and everything was always cleaned up afterwards, and church services for all the denominations were held in sequence the following Sunday morning. The place was always ready for it, because many of the denominations did not have their churches built in the town, and your mother and dad opened up their house for church services every Sunday morning. Do you remember anything about this?
No, and I wish I did. I think that's a very interesting recollection. I don't recall any of the religious part of it at all, but I can verify the fact that my dad was not a drinker, even a social drinker. He very seldom even took a cocktail or a drink. He just didn't enjoy it and didn't like it. He wasn't opposed to it, but it didn't. I think it was probably his stomach more than anything else.
All right. I wanted to establish that your father really, at this point in his life, was quite a remarkable man. And he was so remarkable and so successful, though there were certain resentment, especially about from the people whose toes he stepped on in the process of crusading for various causes. He was quite a liberal, which was kind of, well, that's of youth, I guess. We'll put it that way. He's a young man. He was really quite liberal for the times, and the conservative Central Oregonians at the time, I'm sure, the people especially whose toes he stepped on, resented it. However, he was so well recognized as a doer and as a man who had the pulse of the people, so to speak, that the most popular governor that Oregon ever had, up to McKay, at that time selected your father to be his personal secretary. And I believe your family probably moved to Salem at that time.
I think that's right. I know he was the secretary to the governor for some time, but of course I don't recall any of those things personally. Most of my recollections of that, those early days, are things that I've read and been told since then.
Well, now, your father, this was just about the time of World War I. Your father belonged to the Oregon National Guard at the time, and I know that there was no secretary, there was no office of Secretary of State at the time, and really the personal secretary to the governor was probably, I hate to bring up the word haldeman, but was probably about the second most important position in the state executive government at that time. And your father was very influential in many ways. As an example, if you remember, this is about the time that women's suffrage became effective and when the women got the vote. And as your mother tells the story, your father had arranged for her to be the first woman to vote in the state of Oregon. But at the last moment, they were at the governor's mansion or at the state capitol, I can't remember which, when the time came to vote, your mother thought it was only proper that the governor's wife be the first one to vote, and she acquiesced to her. And so your mother, according to her story, was the second woman to ever vote in Oregon. She voted immediately behind the governor's wife. Have you ever heard that story?
I've never heard the story, but it sounds like my mother.
Well, now, about this time, well, we'll put the time frame around 1920. Now, Your mother came from a rather wealthy family, I believe.
Her dad was Edwin Binney, who was head of and one of the founders of Binney and Smith, which is internationally known by the trademark Crayola. It was a wax crayon business. I think they now have 80% of the world market. In those days, I suppose they were considered quite wealthy. It wasn't wealth as it's known today, but in those days it was very substantial. And I think the family was very fond of my dad, but I think they were a little bit shocked that their daughter Dorothy would go out into the boondocks of the far west. And I suppose that in 1913 it was pretty rough country. And the fact that he got away with all the things he did out there is quite a feather in his cap as far as I'm concerned. They moved back to Rye, New York, I think, was the first place that I can recall, which was right near old Greenwich, Connecticut, where my mother came from.
Would that be about 1920?
I don't remember. Must have been. If I would have guessed that it would have been earlier than that.
Do you think you went to school anywhere in Oregon?
I don't believe I did. I may have gone to a kindergarten type of thing because my mother brags about how I won a baby contest one time. But my first recollection really is going to the Rye Country Day School. And I must have been quite young then. So 20 would probably be more or less that. It could have been earlier.
See, where was George born? Do you remember?
My brother? He must have been born in Rye, New York.
So in 21, then?
Yeah, something like that.
They were back in Rye.
Because George is 8 years younger than I. So he was probably born in Rye, New York.
All right. Now, did they build the house in Rye?
No. No, it was an old house right on the Boston Post Road. In Rye, which is between New York and Old Greenwich, Connecticut.
Well, getting back just a little bit to your father. Do you remember where your father was born?
I should, but I don't. It doesn't come to me now. His background was all General Israel Putnam family in Greenwich, Connecticut, what is now Greenwich, Connecticut.
Your father came from a very illustrious family.
It was a publishing family.
Yes, I... Your grandfather, I believe, or great uncle, I'm not sure which it is,
yeah.
But was very prominent, and of course he was working between England and the United States.
Right. I think the Putnam Publishing Company in those days was called G.P. Putnam's, and then it was G.P. Putnam Sons and G.P. Putnam and Son, and it was New York and London. And I think the American one was the second oldest publishing house in the United States. Now you're going to ask me what the first one was, and I can't tell you.
Well, I won't bother with that, but I will put into here that he was, in order to protect his books that he was bringing over from England from being pirated by the press, because there was no international copyright laws, he was one of the prime motivating forces in establishing international copyright laws. And in order to protect his business was probably the motivation behind it, but it was necessary because the world was becoming internationally involved to have international copyright laws. Up until that time, something published in England could be pirated and published in the United States without any fees being paid whatsoever, which was grossly unfair. And he was very, very instrumental in establishing these international laws, regardless of what his motivation for doing it was. And also your Uncle Herbert, I believe, or was that your father's brother?
Yeah. Bob. Wasn't it Robert?
Well, there was two. One mm-hmm. basically established the Library of Congress as
right.
we know it today. That was Robert, was it? Can you remember?
I don't remember which one it was. I knew Robert, but I did not know the other one. I think he died before I was old enough to remember.
Do you have any recollections of family stories about... It comes from a very illustrious family.
Yes, I'm aware of that. He is like his father, though. He's very restrained.
No, I'm not trying to be restrained. I'm trying to dig out all these things, and I think that Elgin knows far more about my family background.
Don't worry about
than I do.
Accuracy of name.
No, no,
I have all
no.
the early books that we
No, you probably know a great deal more about it because I've never been a student of family background or particularly given it a great deal of thought. I've always been proud and happy to be part of it. And what we're leading into is my dad's connection with Amelia, and
that's quite a ways down the line. Yeah.
It's quite a ways down the line, but I want to get it off my mind while I'm thinking about it. He was so much more of a delightful, smart, fun, good, thoughtful man than has been given credit for in his connection with Amelia, and I just wanted to put that on the record for your future notes while we're thinking about it.
David has told me quite a bit about their home in Rye, so maybe that would be
appropriate, yeah, to talk about that.
I have some pictures of it, if you'd ever like to.
Well, I don't know which home you're referring to. I think Patricia's referring to a more modern home. The first home that I recall was back in the very early days when I was just a little squirt going to the Rye Country Day School. The period she's referring to is considerably later, when I was, a young explorer, and I'd been to the Arctic with my dad on expeditions and taken my own expeditions. The home that she's referring to is a spectacularly interesting, delightful place. It was also in Rye, but it was a big, rambling, attractive place.
Is that the one with the circular window?
Yes. Yes.
The one that burnt down about 1935.
Well, it didn't burn down completely. We had a very bad fire, and unfortunately my dad lost a fabulous collection of books. We were all collectors of sorts, and he loved old books, and he had some beautiful stuff, particularly on the Arctic. Original books that had hand watercolor paintings in lieu of photographs, very famous Arctic exploration and that sort of thing. But that was when I was a teenager. So there was an interim between the old house in Rye and the new one, and during that period was the time when we started the expeditions. At the age of 12, I was with William Beebe as a cabin boy in the Pacific. And because he was a publisher, all these people used to visit, and our house was always filled with Roy Chapman Andrews, William Beebe's, and Lindbergh's, and people like that. I don't know where to pick up from there.
Well, now, we'll go back just a little ways. I'm just putting on tape to jog my own memory. You remember how Rye got its name?
No.
Your family was involved in it. It was quite a hiatus.
Oh, that's hard to believe. I thought Rye had been there for quite a while. It was Rye when we moved there, as I recall, but I don't remember where the name came from.
Actually, your family established the post office there, and there was quite a bunch of names they were going to call it. It ended up Rye, but...
I'd never heard that.
Well,
that's very interesting. I didn't hear that, Pat. Did you?
What, sweetheart? What?
That Elgin said that my family was involved in having the first post office opened in Rye.
We're thinking the same about the postal rates today.
And they didn't know what to call it. And they had a whole bunch of names. It ended up Rye, but it was quite a story in itself.
Mm-hmm.
I have some books that you might as well have when I'm finished with them, because they give an awful lot of your family history, going clear back to the first part of the
19th century. I'd love to borrow them. And
you'd be welcome to them.
We have one even written. Well, we had recently a chance to get the journal, but we didn't get it.
You know, it was quite expensive, and it was about a trip that your grandfather took to Europe, and he wrote a journal as he took the trip. And I had a chance to buy it. I can probably relocated.
The Putnam grandfather?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The original G.P. Putnam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess G.P. Putnam the first thing.
Yeah.
Now, okay, did your folks build, did your mother and dad build the new house at Rye?
Yes. Yeah, started from scratch.
Right.
Fabulously interesting house. My earliest recollections of the tremendous excitement and pleasures of having all kinds of internationally famous people, whether they were opera singers or authors or explorers, or in those days even early flyers. And as a matter of fact, the first time I met Amelia Earhart, she was a guest at the house because she had just been selected as the gal to fly the ocean following the Lindbergh deal, and she was a guest at our house first. At that time, my mother was married to Dad, and that part of it is an interesting story in itself. They were both married 3 or 4 times, as I'm sure you know. But the earliest recollection, we had a grand piano in a very lovely big, oh, how do you describe the story and a half gabled room? Living rooms. There was a grand piano in there, and we also had what would be termed the more formal living room today. And they were separated by guest rooms in quite a long hall. And many a weekend, famous pianists or singers would compete jokingly with each other from one end of the house to the other, and so you could have drawn out the other one. We had Muriel Pollock playing the piano, we had Ronald Warrenrath singing, and we'd have Roy Chapman Anders off in the corner discussing a book with Dad, and it was really a wonderful way to grow up.
How would you describe your mother at this period of time?
She was a very, very charming hostess, loved people. We always had a house full of guests. And of course, in those days, one had help, so there were always 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 people for meals. There were almost every weekend there would be from 2 to 6 guests, and almost always there were always stimulating, exciting people. She was a very handsome, good-looking hostess, loved everybody and was very popular with everybody. But I think both my mother and my dad were kind of leaders, and that may have been what led up to their first divorces.
Well, now, your mother and father returned from Oregon, and I really don't know why. Your father was very successful in Oregon. Probably was in a position to really enter politics if that was his bag, or the publishing business if that, you know, was his thing.
Well, I think the answer to that, Elgin, is pretty obvious. He was very successful, as you say, in the publishing business, and he had created quite a reputation in the East with his articles and writing. But I think his main heart was in publishing, which was already there, and his family probably wanted him to come in and get more deeply involved in that, because it was becoming quite a large business. So I think probably the Oregonian part of the history was a stepping stone into getting to know the public and getting to the feeling of being able to stand on his own feet before he got involved in big Eastern business, if you want to call it that.
Well, now, financially, correct me if I'm wrong, I do not believe that the publishing business had had its ups and downs. And at this particular point in time, I do not believe that, basically, while sound, I don't believe that the financial structure of the family would be considered wealthy. That is, all contrary. They were.
From his point of view, I don't think money made an awful lot of difference. I think the thing boiled down to more of a challenge. He'd love to have challenges, whether it was a prank or a book or a project. He was an idea man. I guess during that time. He was probably noted as one of the best publicists of the country. He was a great promoter of publicity for his products, which could be the same whether you're in politics or printing or manufacturing, I guess.
Well, now,
I don't think the money had much to do with it. I don't think he was a type. He was too outspoken to be a politician, which you've already proven by your remarks as to how he opposed corruption or misuse of public funds and so forth in Bend. My guess would be that he didn't want to go into politics because he knew he couldn't be a success at it because he was too frank and too honest.
Was Dorothy, do you remember if you have any aunts or remember how large her family was?
Oh, yeah. Mother had two sisters and a brother. Her brother, June Binney, was a world champion swimmer at Yale. He was on the world swimming team that toured all over the place with Duke Kahanamoku from Hawaii. And I can remember as a youngster there visiting my mother's family in Old Greenwich, Connecticut.
Was this the connection to George Blanding?
No, to Don Blanding.
Don Blanding, I'm sorry.
Don Blanding was an artist in Hawaii, and he had been a friend of the family's for years. Now, where the connection came from, I don't believe it came directly from Hawaii. I think it was through mutual friends in California or something like that, which probably occurred when they were in Oregon, because I know they've been friends for years and years and years. Later, he became poet laureate of Hawaii and was a famous poet and writer and artist. He did some beautiful black and white stuff, and they eventually got married. I think he was number three, and lots of fun, but that didn't last too long, but they were parted on a very friendly basis.
Do you remember him at all in Oregon?
I don't remember Don Blanding at all in Oregon. But when he did come east and when my mother married him, I knew him intimately. And, of course, during that period of time, I was shown snapshots and photo albums of early days.
Do you ever know what happened to those albums?
Hello, George.
No, I would imagine my mother. My gosh, there's my... I've got to go. This is my call for Greece.
Give you privacy if you want. Two living rooms?
Yeah, well, I told you about the two pianos on the one out of the top. This one of them was very rustic with a tremendous rock wall and a huge fireplace and a polar bear rug in front of it, and the windows on one side looked out and we were on the top of it. And you looked in the top of elms and dogwoods and everything else. It was really a lovely setting. You say you've seen the house or you have pictures of it with the roundup. Well, the round window was more or less in the center of the house. That was the entrance. The room on your left with the slate roof was the big room I'm talking about. In between that room and the living room or the window that you're talking about that you remember were three guest rooms off a hall, two on one side and one on the other. And one of the bedrooms was painted by Isabel Cooper, who was one of...
I do too, because this sets the scene for that era.
It's on.
Isabel Cooper had painted one of the guest rooms, walls and ceiling of South American jungle. And if you look very carefully, and it was beautifully done, you could see birds and snakes and all sorts of tropical flowers and everything else. And there was that room was separated by an underwater guest room, which was painted by also by one of Bibi's artists. And the walls were coral and little schools of fish and sea bottom stuff, and the ceiling was even painted with bubbles and little bits of seaweed and stuff. The whole room was an underwater marine thing, which was quite unusual, and I guess it still is. But the
did that survive the fire?
Yes. The fire was in the middle of the house. The fire started in the basement with an oil heater, and the fire was more or less under and a little bit to the right of that circular window. But it gutted, it came up through, it ruined my dad's den, and I had a a den above it in the bedroom, and it kind of gutted that part of the house, so I lost most of my collection, and he lost all his books and stuff. But those two guest rooms, which Patricia mentioned, were awfully interesting and really different and delightful.
Well, now, the house was probably built in the mid-20s, or early 20s, right on 23, 24, 25, sometime in that.
It had to be, yeah.
Okay. Your mother and your father were both rather independent, intelligent.
Both of them brilliant people, and I think probably my mother may have resented my dad's being closer to celebrities than she really was. That's a kind of a crude way of putting it, but I think there was a little bit of that.
There was a little personality conflict.
Well, they were both very not hard-headed, but they were both very dominating people. And mother was very attractive, and to my knowledge, dad didn't fool around a lot, but I think my mother may have been inclined to. Nothing that I ever noticed, but looking back on it, I think it's pretty obvious. I don't even remember the terms of the divorce, but it seemed to be reasonably friendly. My guess has always been that she wanted to be more on her own feet than she was with him. And she married a sea captain named Frank Upton, who had been captain. He had been very, very famous and highly decorated during the war as one of the most famous marine skippers, the run to Murmansk and all that sort of thing. He ended up as the captain on the America, I believe it was, America's newest transatlantic vessel. But he turned out to have a gambling alcohol problem, so that didn't last very long. And then she married Don Blanding, and they were divorced, and then she married a man named Lewis Palmer, whom I didn't like very much. He had family interests in Central America, and he died of a heart attack when they were in New York on a theater weekend.
Well, getting back to, we'll pick up the Amelia Earhart portion. Now, Amelia was selected by Mrs. Guest, selected some people to select her, and your father was one of those people, I believe.
Yeah, I think it was sort of not a committee type of thing, but it was sort of a let's get a group together and analyze it carefully and try to pick out somebody that would fit the bill. Women were not in aviation, and they wanted to get somebody who had some background in flying, who was attractive and intelligent. They didn't want to just pick up some gal flyer. And Amelia was selected more or less by a group. No guests were part of it, and I've forgotten who else was involved with it. Anyhow, everybody, once they decided on Amelia, just fell in love with her. She was really a very, very remarkable woman. She wasn't beautiful, but her sweetness and her intelligence made her most, most attractive. But I think her greatest attribute was the fact that she was exactly the same with a mechanic in the garage or in an airport as she was with the President of the United States. And consequently, everybody, every walk of life, just not only loved her, but respected her tremendously. Had absolutely no semblance of airs or snobbishness or anything like that. None of it ever went to her head at all. And she was not a publicity hound. As a matter of fact, she rather disliked it. She'd much rather be alone with a group of nice people and that type of thing.
Well, now, when she was selected to make that flight, they left from Boston and went up to Trepassey, Newfoundland, and then from there took off to fly across the Atlantic and eventually ended up in Wales. But they had a lot of trouble en route.
it happened that Mr. Stultz, who was the pilot of the airplane, also had an alcohol problem. And while they were in Tripoli, they had all sorts of difficulty getting him sober, the weather and the airplane and everything all together at the same time. As a matter of record, I'm just putting this in, kind of jump along, they actually took off with him half under the influence, and he was not exactly sober when they took off, but it was as close to sober as they could get him and have the weather and everything in their favor at the same time. But anyway, it ended up, Lou Gordon was rather a very helpful mechanic, co-pilot sort of fellow, but not very forceful. And the telegrams that were sent back and forth between your father, mainly, and Amelia and Trepassey, she became more or less the leader of the expedition in that behind the scenes, being that Stultz was the pilot, she couldn't take direct command, but she was manipulating the operation to the extent trying to get it off the ground. They got stuck there for something, I can't remember whether it was 12 days or 17
days. Yeah, I think that's very well put, because she was not actually one of the pilots. She was really technically a passenger on the flight. Lou Gordon was a pretty steady guy, but as you pointed out, he was not a forceful man. So I imagine during that period, with Amelia's guidance and help, Lou sort of took over, even though Stultz, who was a hell of a good pilot, probably did the landings and takeoffs, but I imagine most of the responsibility was between Gordon and Amelia, although I don't believe she ever touched the control.
No, she didn't, at least as a matter of record.
Yeah.
Now, your father evidently commissioned her to do a book immediately after that.
Well, I think that was his basic reasoning on the whole thing.
He'd had such tremendous success with We, I guess.
Right, right. And the fact that she was the first woman to have flown the Atlantic. All of the thing was probably what you might term his promotion of a new book, and it happened to be Amelia. But in the meantime, they all became very good friends. In the meantime, she had done quite a bit of flying on her own. I think she had a moth, a British moth.
Yes,
she flew quite a bit.
She bought from Lady Heath.
Right.
Avion.
Avion, yeah.
And the folding wings.
Yeah.
And as a matter of record, later on that fall, when she got back from that trip, she flew that airplane clear across to Los Angeles and back to New York, which was really the first round-trip solo flight of record ever made by a woman.
Well, almost every flight she made there for several years was a record of some sort. That trip was the first one. And then she went into the helicopters and the autogyros and then into the Lockheeds.
Getting back to the book for a moment, she wrote the book evidently at Rye.
Yes.
And the dedication to the book, which was called 19 Hours and 40 Minutes, the dedication to the book is to Dorothy Binney Putnam, under whose roof tree this book was written.
She was a house guest and a friend of all of ours at that time.
Well, there's another story that comes in here that we've heard, and we don't know how much truth there is in it. What happened actually between your mother, your father, and Amelia?
Well, I think obviously there must have been some jealousy on my mother's part. She must have felt that he was getting pretty involved with Amelia. But as far as I know, there was no hanky-panky at all during that period. She was just what she was there for, which was a new woman flyer who was writing a book, which is highly promoted by my dad's publishing company. But as far as I recall or have any gut feelings about, she was just like any other celebrity guest in the house, and there was nothing going on. Now, there may have been, I don't know.
You were not aware that there was anything
I never had any inkling until a divorce came up, and of course my mother, as far as I was concerned, sort of blamed it on my dad's affair with Amelia. But mother still talks that way, and there are a lot of things that she says that I've since found out were not true, and I in support of my dad, I would say that there wasn't anything to it at the time. Obviously it came afterwards, and they did fall in love, and she didn't want to get married. He insisted on that, and I'm sure you know all about that story.
You really feel then, don't let me put words in your mouth, correct me, but I gather from what you said that you really feel that a subliminal motivation for your mother's divorce was she really wanted her independence.
I think that was a lot more important, and to me, looking back on it, I think that the Amelia thing was sort of an excuse. Now, that may be entirely wrong. Maybe my dad was having an affair with her, but I doubt it. She wasn't that kind of a woman.
And you knew her quite well.
Oh, very well. I lived with her